In the 1940s, the pulpit master Harry Emerson Fosdick delivered a tremendous sermon which is circulated to this day. It was titled, "The Importance of Doubting Your Doubts." And in it he said, the antidote to doubt is not faith. Doubting doubt, he said, is the first step before the leap of faith. If you want to believe, and if you want to have deep faith, first of all, you have to fight doubt on doubt. And this seems to me applies also to the disappointments and the discouragements and the defeats which all of us will encounter in life. And what becomes of us in those times, I suppose, is a matter of strength. We can either shrug our shoulders and treat the defeat as fate and cave in, or we can pray for broad and strong shoulders in order to bear up under the discouragements and the defeats that come our way. In his memoir, Telling Secrets, Frederick Buechner describes the anguish that he and his wife experienced over their daughter. He writes, "What happened was that she stopped eating. We didn't think much of it at first. It was just the sort of thing that any girl who thought she'd be prettier if she lost a few pounds might do. But then as the months went by, it became scary. Anorexia nervosa was the name of the sickness from which she was suffering. And he says, as a father, he was helpless. Nothing he did worked. He argued, he pleaded, he warned, and he bribed her to please start eating, all to no avail. They sent her to a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist told him that he could do nothing to cure her, and that the best thing he could do, which didn't seem like a best option at all, was to stop trying to do anything. And he writes, the only way I knew to be a father was to care for her, to move heaven and earth to make her well. And of course, I could not do that. I did not have the wisdom. I did not have the power to make her well. To parents who have seen their children in distress, they will know precisely what he means, because you will do anything within your power to save your child. No cost is too high. No sacrifice is too great. I think about Angie. You saw her on the video we showed a few weeks ago as she was promoting the Nigerian relief auction. When I was her pastor, Alyssa, her daughter, then 7 years old, was diagnosed with a rare form of cancer. It was so rare that after extensive lab studies, they determined that there were only 3 children in the world under age 14. Who had this same issue. They flew in a surgeon from Denver and one from Nashville to perform a 10-hour surgery on Alyssa at Riley Children's Hospital. And I remember sitting with the family, and her mother, Angie, cried out, I am absolutely at the end of my rope because I can't do a single thing to help my little girl. I am absolutely helpless. And the anguish with which she said that just shook us all. And yet, strangely enough, not long after that, she said, just being able to say those words. That in itself was comforting because she realized at the point where her strength came to an abrupt end, that there was someone who would carry that for her, someone who cared for Alyssa more than she could ever imagine. November 28th, 1977, seems like yesterday to me. I can see my parents' wearied faces as my sister lay in a coma from which she would not wake up. And every fiber of their being was crying out to God, do something! You've got to do something! And their faith was only hanging by this little thread. And this fragile, crazy hope that somehow Anne would open her eyes and say to us in the clearest of voices, don't worry, it's all going to be all right. Well, it didn't turn out all right. You know, it's hard not for parents to read this gospel text today and not feel a close bond with this heartsick father who pleaded with Jesus to heal his daughter. In last Sunday's lesson, Jesus and the disciples sailed to the west side of the Sea of Galilee. You will remember that on the way they hit a storm and Jesus was sound asleep like a baby on the deck of that ship, and the disciples were screaming like a bunch of girls, and Jesus stood up and told the storm to be calm, and he brought them to dry land in the region of the Gentiles. Now, this shore and that shore couldn't be further apart, not in terms of miles. Because this was Jewish territory, this was Gentile territory. The people on the opposite shores loathed one another. And so when Jesus jumped out on the Gentile side, he went about preaching and teaching, and things could have gone better for him. He healed a deranged man, and the people were so scared, they told him to get out of town and not bother coming back. So they hopped back in the boat and sailed back the other way. Now, it's interesting to know that in the Gospel of Mark, he treats that sea as a kind of liquid boundary between Jew and Gentile. Storms blow in that watery boundary. But here's Jesus not only willing to cross it, but with his power being able to calm it. And Mark is telling us something very important here. And he uses the storm as the symbol of hate, a hate that Jesus was determined to cross. Now, we're back on the other shore. No sooner had he climbed from a boat than a man named Jairus fell at his feet. He was a respected leader of the synagogue. He was a member of the religious establishment. And he was this heart-sick father pleading with Jesus to please heal his daughter. And he begged Jesus to come to his house where his 12-year-old daughter lay dying. And he said, I know that if you just lay hands on her, she will be healed. Now here's where Mark uses a popular literary device of his day. He takes two stories and he weaves them together. He starts off with Jairus and Jesus, then switches to the woman with the hemorrhage, and then back to Jairus. And he's drawing some parallels in here. Notice the number 12. What's the significance of that number? The 12 tribes of Israel, 12 disciples. The girl is 12 years old. The woman has a flow of blood for 12 years, the entire span of that little girl's life. Both of the women in this story are in crisis. Their names are not given, but we know their need. They are both now outsiders because their conditions have rendered them unclean, and the law strictly prohibited anyone from being close, especially even touching them, because they themselves would be unclean. And as Jesus and Jairus worked their way through the crowd, this woman who tried to disguise herself as best she could from the public crawled up behind him and just with the index finger just, as in some texts say, touch the hem of his garment. And as she did, something happened to her. You know, she had gone from specialist to specialist, and they couldn't heal her. Her insurance provider dropped her. She had hardly any money left, and so that she spent on quack cures, none of which helped her, and Jesus was her last and best bet. You know, desperate people will do desperate things. And there comes a point after the tests and the treatments and the trials that you're willing to try anything. You fly to the Philippines because you hear there's a pharmacist there who has created this chemical cocktail that has cured people with just your condition. And so you hop on the plane and you go to Manila, where you are put on a 2-month fruit-only diet. You drink gallons of herbal extracts. You meditate and you chant 4 hours a day. And the result is nothing. Nothing changes. Now, some of your translations, it says this woman suffered from a flow of blood. That word flow in Greek means a river. For 12 years, a river of life flowed from her. Only one option left. Touch the hem of the garment. And Jesus turned to see who had touched him, and she fell trembling at his feet. And it's interesting what he calls her, first of all, daughter. She is now a daughter of Abraham. He has restored her from the realm of the unclean unto the community. Don't be afraid, he said, because your faith has made you well. Now let's get back to the first story, shall we? Jairus did not care what the people of the synagogue thought. His daughter was dying. And you need to know that in those days, fathers were not supposed to get all that worked up over daughters. The sons were more important. You grieved and grieved over a son because a son was the one who was going to carry on your family name. And he knew that, but none of that mattered to him. Jairus' love for his daughter trumped all the rules. But while they're on their way, Jairus receives word that his daughter is dead. Don't bother bringing the preacher with you. And Jairus is now beginning to wonder, maybe he made a mistake. Instead of taking all those hours to find Jesus, maybe he should have stayed by his little girl's side, reassuring her as best he could, but Jesus, knowing this, said to him, do not fear, don't be afraid. And I want you to picture the scene when they arrive. The professional wailers were at work. Now, did you know that in those days, they could hire people, just like we hire caterers today and photographers, you hired professional wailers to come in and cry and cry and cry. And when Jesus arrived, he told them to pipe down and said he hadn't come all that way for a funeral. And so Jesus and three of the disciples and the mother and father went into the room where the little girl lay, and he took her hand and he spoke just 2 words to her, get up. And she did. Give this kid something to eat, Jesus said. She starved. And that was that. You know, Frederick Buechner says, we should all see ourselves in the place of that little girl. Imagine him taking you by the hand and telling you to get up. Just get up and live. He says, you who believe, and you who sometimes believe, and sometimes don't believe much of anything at all, and you who would give almost anything to believe if you only could, get up, he says. All of you, just get up and live. What I hear going on here is this, that in Jesus' presence, the dead don't stay dead. Easter followed Jesus wherever he went. And what we are always facing when life comes at us is that choice between faith on one hand, fear on the other. Defeat on one side, victorious living on the other. And if you want it in its darkest of terms, it's the choice between life and death. You know, there's something about us that gets so enamored with death that we don't see life. We're the crowd outside of Jairus' house. Don't bother with Jesus. Let's just sign the death certificate and just get on with the wailing. You know, and I know you know this is true, we talk ad nauseum about the great power of the love of God, and then we let ourselves get jerked around. Too bad about Bill's drinking. He's back on the bottle again. He's tried everything. I guess we'll chalk another one up to defeat. I have a wonderful little book I'll loan you if you promise to bring it back to me. It's by Henry Nouwen. It's called The Life of the Beloved, and in it he describes this as our condition. He said, look at the many if questions if we raise. What am I going to do if I don't find a spouse, a house, a job, a friend, a benefactor? What am I going to do if they fire me, if I get sick, if an accident happens or I lose my friends? What if my marriage doesn't work out? What if war breaks out? What if tomorrow the weather is bad and the buses are on strike and there's an earthquake? What if someone steals my money, breaks into my house, rapes my daughter, and kills me? What if? And it is into this condition that the stiller of the storm and the healer of the woman and the little girl comes to us, because he hates defeat and he hates the grip that death has upon us. If I've learned anything in the course of my ministry, I've learned at least this, and you know it as well, misery loves company. The power of negative attracts negative. People will carry on about what's wrong and whose fault it is, and the more they gripe, the better they feel. They talk about the declining church or the dying church, and they get some kind of perverse sweet satisfaction out of that, knowing that there are other churches as bad off as their own. I once asked a church consultant, what's the one thing you say that can be done to revive the mainline church? And he said, it's simple. Just tell stories. Tell stories of churches that were born again and raised from the dead. Defeated churches can't stand stories of success. But I'll tell you, nothing defeats defeat. Nothing dispels negativity more than a good story of resurrection. I served at a church that was going through a transition. It was a very, very hard time, and there was one individual who was always quick to tell me that we weren't going to make it, that we weren't going to turn the ship around. And he loved it when we said we're starting a capital campaign. And he said to me, there are a lot of reasons why this isn't going to work. And he said, you, and pointing at me, he said, you're going to be lucky if you can get $45,000. Now, we didn't get it. No, he didn't get it. No. Oh, there was a four in the number, but the number was $436,000. And with all of my being, I wanted to go up to him and say, ha! $45,000, huh? I didn't. I would need to be offering a prayer of confession if I did, but it was a dramatic example of how despair and discouragement and defeat and negativity can stifle us in our individual lives. It can stifle us in the church, which is why last week in that story of the disciples caught in the storm that Jesus says to the storm and to the disciples, stifle it, won't you? Because it's not about defeat. It's not about death. Don't let your faith be jerked around by all of the predictions. Don't be afraid. Only believe. Get yourselves up and go in peace. And now I must tell you that this week the church received an eviction notice. We chose this time to tell you. We didn't want the word to get out and there to be anything inaccurate said, but we are going to be, I'm sorry to say, evicted. And here's what the notice said. You are hereby banished from the house of fear forever. With malice and forethought, you have flagrantly withheld the monthly rent of guilt, anxiety, fear, and shame and self-condemnation. You have adamantly refused to worry about your salvation. Already I heard one dismal tenant say, well, there goes the neighborhood. Your freedom from fear is not only dangerous, it's contagious. Real estate values have plummeted. Gullible investors are hard to find. Why? Because of your callous and your carefree rejection of slavery and defeat. A pox on you and all of you deluded lovers of liberty. Signed, the Prince of Darkness.